We're going to start the meeting. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but that'll probably be here in a few minutes. So why don't we start with the first bill, House File 586, Representative Bly.
Mm-hmm.
Is he here? There he is. And since we don't have a quorum, we won't move the bill yet, but go ahead and tell us about it.
I do have an amendment, so when we move the bill, I'd like to introduce that, too. So I'm Representative David Bly from District 25B, and I have a bill here that would help out some nursing homes in my area. And during my campaign, I met with nurses in the area, and this particular issue is one that came up as a high priority for the nurses. And I also met with the two CEOs at the nursing homes, and this was also a high agenda item on their issue as well, on their issue list as well. And what it amounts to is that we would like to have the metro rate area apply to these nursing homes as well. They compete in a market where the Northfield Hospital is almost across the street from one of these nursing homes, and because it's in Dakota County, is part of the metro reimbursement regime, and they are not. So rather than say more about that, I'd like to have the two testifiers I have here talk to some of the issue. So.
Identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name is Leon Hansen. I am the Vice President of Community Relations and Fund Development at the Northfield Retirement Community in Northfield, Minnesota. My testimony today deals with the current issue of having our community literally in two different counties in the state of Minnesota. Normally, this would not cause much of a problem for long-term care facilities. However, during the past year and a half into the foreseeable future, having parts of our community in both Dakota and Rice counties have become a major stumbling block for recruiting and retaining nursing home staff. Our dilemma is this. Some time ago, our local community hospital opened its doors to a brand new medical center complete with a 40-bed long-term care facility. The new location is in Dakota County and is less than a mile from our nursing home and just over a mile from Pat Vincent's nursing home, Three Links Care Center. Under the current payment rate system for nursing facilities, the Hospital Long-Term Care Center is considered a metro facility under the geographical grouping 3 definition of the current rate system. Both Northfield Retirement Community and Three Links Care Center are considered rural and are listed in geographical group 2 of the current reimbursement system. Based on the weighted average wage rates in Minnesota nursing facilities, there is approximately $3 per hour difference for all nursing positions between Geographical Group 3 and Geographical Group 2. This is just differences in salary and does not account for the differences in benefits, such as pension, health insurance, holidays, and paid time off. Also, under the current Medicare reimbursement system, being in Dakota County provides for an additional $20 per Medicare resident day over being in Rice County. An example of that, Mr. Chairman, is using Farmington as an example. For the average daily rate per resident is $163.87. Northfield Hospital Long-Term Care is $159.73, while we at the Northfield Retirement Community at $133.33, a difference of $30.54 to the highest one in Farmington. Three Links Care Center's average is at $140.93. Due to these substantial differences, we are unable to compete in our own community for similar staff positions in the area of salary and benefits. While we know that the state cannot control the reimbursement of the federal government, we need immediate help to remedy this unfair competitive advantage. We are very concerned that without changes to include the current proposed language of including nursing facilities within 2 miles of Dakota or Scott County as part of the metro area will only serve to exacerbate an already serious situation in our community. It is my belief that the two facilities we represent, Pat and I, are a handful of care centers that actually meet the criteria of being within 2 miles of the current seven-county metro area. Literally, the property line for our particular campus is less than 100 feet from Dakota County. Failure for our two long-term care facilities to be in an equal playing field with our neighbors right next door will continue to provide ongoing stress to our organizations and will create significant problems with our recruitment and retention of our staffs for years to come. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and thank you to Representative Bly for allowing us and inviting us to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Go ahead.
Ready for me?
Please,
okay.
give your name for the tape.
Yes. Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Vincent, and I am CEO Administrator of Three Links Care Center in Northfield, Minnesota. I'm here today to offer testimony on House File 586 related to the designating certain nursing homes or nursing facilities in Rice County as metro for the purposes of determining reimbursement rate. Three Links Care Center sits 1.2 miles from the Dakota County line, as you heard Leon say. You've heard my colleagues at the Northfield Care Center have the northern boundary of Dakota County right at their property line. Dakota County is geographical group 3, a metro region for rates setting by the Department of Health and Human Services. Rice County is considered a rural region for rate setting. House File 586 addresses the need for nursing facilities within 2 miles of Scott or Dakota counties to be considered metro for the purposes of rate setting. And I think Mr. Bly has an amendment that will actually put some money with this bill, so that would be helpful for us. With our rural designation for rate setting, it is virtually impossible to compete with the Northfield Hospital and the Southern Metro facilities for wages and benefits. This is especially true for nurses, where we see a wage disparity of up to approximately $12 per hour for RNs in the rural versus the metro region. It is extremely difficult for us to recruit and retain RNs, LPNs, and CNAs now when they can work at the Northfield Hospital, which is only about 1.4 miles from our property, or drive the short distance to Apple Valley or Burnsville to receive higher wages and benefits. The Northfield Hospital is currently building a clinic on its property and soon will be recruiting staff for that new clinic. In addition, they have new clinics opened or in progress in the Farmington and Lakeville area. I fear that our ability to retain and recruit RNs and LPNs when they can drive as little as 1.4 miles to a new clinic to work better hours and better wages and benefits will really be a problem in the future. I would like to remind you of a bill that was passed in the 2006 session, House File 4162, passed into law stating that the operating rate of all nursing facilities in Benton, Sherburne, and Stearns counties are to be raised to be equal to the median operating rate of facilities in Rule 50, Geographic Group 3. The implementation of this law led to rate increases for all 13 facilities in these counties and produced a total revenue increase for these facilities estimated at more than $6 million in the first year. My recollection of driving from the Twin Cities to St. Cloud and the surrounding areas is that it's a lot further than the 1.2 miles we drive to get from Northfield to Dakota County. I thank you for your consideration of this need. We first introduced this testimony to this committee in 2005. I realize the players have changed. The financial needs of our organization have only grown weaker as we struggle to remain somewhat competitive with wages and benefits for our staff. Designating these facilities within 2 miles of Scott and Dakota County would greatly help our ability to attract and retain quality staff to care for our residents. Please consider our unique situation and help correct this issue. Thank you very much.
I'll call the meeting to order. We have a quorum now. And Representative Pritz, would you like to move the bill?
I will. Representative Chairman, I will move House File 586.
And there is an amendment as well.
Okay, the DE-1 amendment?
Right. So we've moved the bill and the DE-1 amendment. The DE-1 amendment, would you explain that, Representative Bly?
Well, the original language that I had found for the amendment did not actually, put money into the equation, and it was drawn to my attention by staff person at Health and Human Services and gave me the correct language for the bill. So that's for the reason for the need for the change.
Okay. All those in favor of the DE-1 amendment? Any discussion first? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Any further discussion of the bill? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have a bill that would add some other counties, and my fiscal note shows a cost. So I'm wondering, Representative Bly, why your fiscal note shows no cost.
I think that's
Representative Bly.
I think that's because the original language didn't, you know, wasn't showing that. And I apologize for not having that ready for you, but in trying to make the bill right, I'm not sure why the fiscal note didn't come along with that, but it hasn't appeared yet.
Representative Erickson, we're awaiting the fiscal note on this, and when it comes, it'll make our decision as to whether we can afford it or not. Representative Erickson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, is there someone from DHS? I know Greg Tabell signed up on this. Is he present? So, because he's been helping with mine, I know that.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
We would like to know if there's going to be a fiscal note with this bill, 586, as amended.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, there, the fiscal note that you have in front of you is for the bill as introduced, and the amendment will result in costs, of course, but I don't have a preliminary number on that at this point.
And could you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Hild from the Department of Human Services.
Okay, Representative Erickson, does that answer your question? We don't know
yet. Well, Mr. Chair, we'll wait to find out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hild. Any further discussion on this bill? Okay, then I will move that Representative Fritz moves that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As amended. And the next bill is he here? Is Aaron here? He's not here yet. Wow, you missed his chance. Carlton's not here either. Boston. Why don't we go with Representative Lincheski? She has two bills up. Let's start with House File 2149. And I will move House File 2149.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Nice to join you in this committee here today. Thank you for moving House File 2149. And, Mr. Chair, I want to introduce to you Mr. Lundberg. He's the COO of the Minnesota Masonic Home, which is in my district. And I think if it's appropriate, I'd just like him to explain what we're looking to do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I do have a handout if I could have that distributed.
State your name, please, for the
My name is John Lundberg. I'm Chief Operating Officer for the Minnesota Masonic Homes, and I'm here today on behalf of our Bloomington campus, and I welcome the opportunity to be able to be here before this committee. I'd first like just to start by way of some background information for you. The Minnesota Masonic Home was first established in July of 1920, and since that time, our campus in Bloomington has evolved over the years and to its current situation or state of providing skilled nursing care, assisted living, short-term subacute transitional care, memory care services, and independent living. While we are associated with the Masonic community, participation or membership in the Masonic organizations is not a requirement of admission to or access of any of the services that are provided. In 1992, the Minnesota Masonic Organization, looking at the demographics and the situations in the Bloomington and surrounding community, developed a plan and project to move forward with the development of a new skilled building on its campus. that would create a 120-bed long-term care facility on its campus in Bloomington. At that point in time, as part of that planning process, it proceeded forward with making an application to the exception to the moratorium process, and at that time was declined an exception. The organization felt very strongly about the product that was being developed, the location, the type of building that was being designed and developed, and the services that would be provided in it. And so at that time chose to proceed with the project, even though it had not been approved under the exception process. What then occurred is that the organization built a new 120-bed unit, which replaced existing 110 units of board and care and 10 existing nursing care units that were already on the campus. That building was constructed in a way that it developed a 60-bed unit for dementia or Alzheimer's-related diseases, and also developed a 60-bed unit transitional short-term care program within that particular structure. It also allowed for the renovation of the previous board and care area of the building to create a 46-unit assisted living program. The building that was developed in our organization, we refer to it as the E building. You aren't going to be able to draw any connection to it, but for purposes of clarity for it, we refer to it as our E building. That the E building, as it was built, continues to be a very solid, important building within our organization, and it's a very workable design in terms of today's requirements and expectations. It is designed in such a way that it creates small subunits, if you will, so that it has 20-bed subunits, which lend itself very well to the type of specialty program that currently is provided and lends itself to the development of future types of specialty development as the needs may change over time. So while it is a building that is 15 years old, it is still very current in terms of its design and its being able to meet the needs of resident populations today as well as into the future. This building maintains an occupancy of 95% occupancy, and of its 96 patient rooms, 72 of those rooms are private rooms. So again, it's a very current kind of a structure that is well equipped to meet the needs of today as well as into the future. Because the organization was not successful in its attempt to fund under the moratorium, the costs of building of this particular building were not able to be incorporated in our property rates, and that's what brings us here today is for, and why we request an enhancement in our property rates to capture the costs associated with this particular building. I have distributed a handout for you that will explain a couple of the points that I'll just note here for you. The first part of that handout, the top section of that handout, will show you an array of the property rates in the state of Minnesota. And you'll see on that particular handout that the Minnesota Masonic Homes property rate is $8.17. The state average for property rate is $12.79. And that would place us at slightly below the 10th percentile in terms of the overall rate structure when compared on that property rate side or component. Looking at that in another way, if you look at a ranking of the 396 nursing facilities in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota Masonic Home on property rate would rank 360th. The second part of that handout is just a formulary that shows how the figure of $6.52 was arrived at. You'll see that it's based on the interest expense for the remaining debt of the building. It's not the debt, it's not the interest relating to the initial debt that was received 15 years ago, but the current debt moving forward. And you'll also see that there have been some discounts in that as it relates to refinancing and other sorts of things that have discounted the actual interest expense. And then based on that 95% occupancy, it brings it back to the $6.52 rate increase. So once again, I would just note for you that the organization had attempted at one point to make an application through the exception process and was denied that application. The building is has long-term viability, provides a very important and effective service in the community today, and is positioned well to be able to do long into the future. And so we hope that you will be able to see your way through to including this legislation and allowing it to move forward.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I didn't...
Mr. Lundberg.
Mr. Lundberg. When you switch from a nonprofit to for-profit status, is that...
That's a different situation, yes.
Okay.
We are a nonprofit, and we continue to be a nonprofit, and that's not changed in our, in the course of time. That, I think that's a different bill that...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong one. I apologize.
Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you, Representative Lachesky, for bringing this forward. I grew up in Bloomington, and it was I remember the Masonic Home as being just a beautiful campus, and my brother was actually married in the chapel there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh. Great.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, House File 2149 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Lincheski, you have another one, but before we get to that, would somebody like to move the minutes? The minutes have been approved, or moved by Representative Murphy. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are passed. Representative Lincheski, House File 1720.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't move the bill since I'm not on
committee. Oh, I will move the bill for you. 1720 has been moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I have to say, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate it. I can't imagine why I am so fortunate to have two bills, this project in my district, to come before this committee this year. It's been a long 8 years and not being able to get these bills forward, so I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, that you have given me these hearings today, and I really appreciate the committee time. House File 1720, I have Mr. Shaw with me, who runs Martin Luther Manor, and if I may, Mr. Chairman and members, I would like Mr. Shaw to explain the situation at Martin Luther Manor.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name's David Shaw. I'm the administrator at Martin Luther Manor. I'll tell you a little bit about us. Martin Luther Manor is a 137-bed nursing home in Flemington. We have 109 units of assisted living, adult daycare program, and adult foster care program. On January 1st of 2007, our facility was sold, changing our status from nonprofit to for-profit. So I'm the other guy. as a result, we'll begin paying property taxes in 2008. Because the government controls almost all of our revenue, we are not able to recover these additional costs on the revenue side. Most nursing facilities, the revenue comes from medical assistance. In Minnesota, you cannot charge private pay residents more than medical assistance because of the rate equalization law. So all of our revenue is fixed. And the medical assistance rates are set by the Department of Human Services. The base rates years ago were based on a facility's historical costs. Those that were for-profit and had property taxes they paid, that was recognized and passed through onto the property rates. If you were a non-profit, it was not passed on. So the actual costs were recognized. To cover the costs on the expense side, Martin Luther Manor would have to cut hours and wages in a number of different departments, including nursing, housekeeping, dietary, and laundry. This could have a negative impact on the quality of life and the quality of care for the residents at our facility. Because of these new operational challenges for the facility, I'm asking you to please support this bill today. Thank you. I should have...
Any questions for Mr. Shaw? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, it says in the bill here that you're asking for an increase of 281 in each case mix payment rate. What is your rate at the present time?
Mr. Shaw.
I don't know. And it's very complicated. We have probably 160 different rates. It's a very complex mechanism based on the acuity of each resident. We have different rates on admission, for the first 30 days, a different rate after that, a different rate if there's a bed hold. So we have multiple rates.
Mr. Shaw, how would you say you fit in with the other rates around the Glen City area?
We appear to be right in the middle.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your rates, you go from a low rate to a high rate. What's your highest rate that you pay right now?
Okay.
Mr. Shaw.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay, Representative Dean was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaw, this is a lot less confusing now with your lined up with a rate bill here. This has always been, since I've been on the committee, this equalization has been a very complicated subject for me to understand relative to other states, and I understand the need to do this. And the arguments for and against equalization when I come in when you talk about this. Could you talk about kind of going forward how you see the stratification of your different folks who live at your place, of the stratification of what you're going to charge and services, of how that menu is going to broaden, or how you see your reimbursements changing with the change in the status, different services for different folks at different prices?
Mr. Shaw.
Well, that's a good question. And I'm not sure quite how to answer it. We do have a variety of services on the campus, ranging from assisted living all the way through a subacute service. And people's needs and conditions vary dramatically. And we have a process where we charge based on their acuity. I'm not. Is that helpful?
Come on.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Could you just explain to me a little bit? I'm just not understanding this fully. Why, first of all, you know, what prompts the change from nonprofit to for-profit status? I assume that when that change is made, that there are certain, well, there must be a reason to do that, and one of the things that people know is going to happen is that then you're going to be liable for property taxes. And could you just explain to me, it just seems, maybe I'll just leave it there. Why is that change being made, and what considerations are made, and how does this affect the facility going forward now?
Mr. Shaw.
Our facility was sold on January 1st from a nonprofit to a for-profit company. The property taxes is one of the difficulties we face with the new ownership. We, in order to offset the cost of the property taxes, we would have to dig into the expense side and trim back our costs so we could pay the property taxes.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, the company that bought the facility, didn't they take this into account? I mean, nobody buys something, a business, unless they think they can make a profit on it. And so, you know, having purchased the business, there are now these extra expenses, and now you're saying, well, we can't make a profit, we can't even break even, I assume you're saying, unless we have this increase in rates. Could you just kind of explain that?
Well, there is a precedent where this kind of legislation is passed, I believe in 2001, and we were hoping to achieve the same status that they had in 2001.
Liebling, if we ever got to rebasing, it's just paid on what their costs are.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I reluctantly venture out, just since this is not my area of expertise at all, and I know, Mr. Chair, that you understand it, but my understanding is that when for-profit rates are set, they include property tax as part of the cost, and when not-for-profit rates are set, they do not include property tax. So While I think many people would argue that the concept of costing nursing homes in the first place is questionable, and what's in and what's out historically is complicated, I think Mr. Shaw is highlighting that there was a status that had that built in, and now they're moving to, or didn't, and now they're moving to one that does, and that has been part of reimbursement, is including the property tax cost in the rates. And I'm looking at Ms. Representative Huntley, Chair Huntley, to see if I've got that even half right.
Representative Lincheski, you have it all right, and maybe you ought to be on this committee. The rest of us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up, so with the chair's comments, so to the testifier, if we did the rebasing, would that make this unnecessary then?
I believe it would.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification then, so I was confused by Representative Lucheski's comments, because I thought, well, if automatically if they go not to a for-profit, they get this different rate that covers property tax, then why are we having this discussion? So is the answer because the rebasing doesn't occur automatically when they shifted status, and so they're not getting the rate that's appropriate for a for-profit, and if so, why the heck
that's
not?
That's correct. They're locked in to the
even when they're
previous status, even though they've changed, okay. And unless we change the law, then
okay.
They're going to get it.
I think we need a larger policy change here then. Yeah. Well, thank you for the clarification.
Okay, any further questions? With that, House File 1720 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And by the way, folks, the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School are here watching what we do. Okay. House File 450, Representative Aaron Peterson. And I will move House File 450. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 450 deals with planned closure rate adjustment in Big Stone County, which is one of the five that I represent, for an 8-bed facility in Clinton, and reassignment to a 50-bed facility in Graceville. And with me today is Todd Powell, the administrator, to explain how we got here.
Go ahead and please give us your name for the tape.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today supporting House Filing 450. My name is Todd Howell, and I'm the administrator at Graceville Health Center located in Graceville, Minnesota. We have 50 Medicare and Medicaid-certified skilled nursing facility beds, a 15-bed critical access hospital, and two rural health clinics. I'm here today to ask for the planned closure rate adjustment for an 8-bed facility previously located in the city of Clinton, Minnesota, that was to have reassignment to Grace Home in Graceville, Minnesota. Initially, the Clinton Providence Center was owned by Graceville Health Center. In 2004, Graceville Health Center decided to close the Clinton Providence Center. With opposition to the closing from the city of Clinton, Graceville Health Center agreed to sell the facility, including 8 skilled nursing facility beds, to the city of Clinton for their use as an 8-bed nursing home assisted living facility. In the purchase agreement, the city of Clinton agreed that if they ever needed to close the remaining beds, they would follow the proper process to transfer the closure rate adjustment to Graceville Health Center. In August 2005, the city of Clinton decided to close the remaining 8 beds and become only an assisted living facility. As stated in the purchase agreement, city of Clinton staff filled out the appropriate paperwork for the planned closure rate adjustment and sent the appropriate page to Graceville Health Center to sign. Paperwork was signed in June 2005 and returned to Clinton for completion and submission prior to the final bed closure. After sending the paperwork back to the city of Clinton, Graceville Health Center staff understood that Clinton staff would file the paperwork pursuant to the contract. The skilled nursing facility beds were closed in Clinton on August 4th, 2005. However, Clinton staff did not submit the paperwork to the Department of Human Services until after the bed closure on September 3rd, 2005. Because the Clinton facility did not file the paperwork in a timely fashion, the planned closure rate adjustment was denied. It is Graceville Health Center's position that we acted in good faith and did everything possible to make sure the rate increase was received. House filing 450 provides a legislative remedy for the situation and allows for Graceville Health Center to be in a position similar to that had the original paperwork been submitted to the Department of Human Services. Members ask for your support of this legislation and would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Members, you might look at the fiscal note. It's one of the larger ones we've dealt with on this committee. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Howell, I will not hold it against you. Mr. Howell actually used to be the administrator of a nursing home, a wonderful nursing home in my district, and I promise I won't hold the fact that you've moved against you when I consider this. So thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Broad.
So Representative Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment, AO7-1414, adding in after line 12, insert effective retroactively from August 4, 2005. You don't have it?
We don't have it.
Oh.
You want to repeat that? Maybe we...
Okay. I've had it for a while. I'm wondering why the committee didn't get it. But it'd be page 1 after line 12, insert effective date. I can give you a copy. I got plenty of them.
So, Mr. Chairman, what would that say there?
This section is, Mr. Chair and members, this section is effective retroactively from August 4, the date that Mr. Howell mentioned, the closure, August 4, 2005.
So I will move that that amendment, and Ms. Holcomb will give a copy to Mr. Chun. Any discussion of that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we've adopted the amendment that sets the effective date retroactively from August 4th, 2005. Any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that change anything with the fiscal note at all? As far as costs?
It probably will. I think this
fiscal the fiscal note we have is from the Senate file, and we understand that this amendment was already in there.
Okay.
So it's $1,000. Any further discussion? Okay, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Peterson, if you want this to go as a separate bill, we could do that as well next week. Just up to you.
Mr. Chair, what do you think is best?
Well, I hadn't thought about it, but with a fiscal note of $1,000, we don't even have to include that, I don't think. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, since it will probably cost more to pass the bill than the fiscal note, could we just write the check right now?
But anyway, the bill's been laid over for possible inclusion, and we'll look at whether you what's best to do it as a separate bill or include it in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
And let's see. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Next we have Representative Carlson, House File 1812. And I will move House File 1812.
Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with the nursing home moratorium and would provide an exception, and it would allow for the transfer of 180 beds from a facility in Minneapolis to Robbinsdale, and it would also provide for an adjustment in the operating rate up to $35 per day and a property payment of the $3,409. I do have letters of support as well from the City of Robbinsdale, the Hennepin County Human Service Department, and with me today to comment on the need. And this is a rather unique facility, as I understand it, one of a kind in the entire state. To testify, we have Sharon St. Mary from the Good Samaritan Society University Specialty Center, who is the administrator there and would administer, as I understand it, the new home in Robbinsdale. And then we have Jerry Zubar, who is the architect for the new facility. And what is happening, the site in Robbinsdale is where there was at one time a nursing home that has been removed. And they would like to then transfer these beds and reconstruct the facility on that same site. So, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, I'll just turn it over to Sharon St. Mary at this point.
Before it's turned over, the members ought to sort of pay attention, because this is a huge issue in this industry, and it's not just this facility. Many of the facilities are, the buildings are 40, 50 years old. They really don't meet the standards that we need today, and somehow we're going to have to start allowing new buildings to be built. So go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, and thank you also committee members for taking the time today to hear our bill. I appreciate the time that you, I know, will devote carefully to consider our request. University Specialty Center is not your average nursing home. In fact, it is like no other nursing home in the state, as Representative Carlson has already indicated. We are a specialty nursing home serving some of the state's most challenging residents. And I've prepared a little folder for you that has a little bit more information. I have pulled some of the data out that I'm telling you today, but please take the time to read it if you would at some time. We are the safety net for other nursing homes when they have residents who present them with behavioral challenges that are too difficult or too dangerous for them to manage in their homes. As other nursing homes are now trying to right-size themselves to reduce their costs, to try to stay afloat in their communities, who do you think they stop serving first? It's the people who demand high staff time and who return low revenue. It's the people who have behavior problems that those small community-based nursing homes stop serving. And that's where we come in. We are often the last option before hospitalization for some, and we are the first hope after hospitalization for others. We provide a cost savings for the state. As an example, we have five residents in our facility that were released to us from the Agua Ching facility that mostly closed last year, except for a small area. The cost of providing care for those five residents at University Specialty Center versus the cost at Agua Ching has saved the state $1,189,719 to date. And four of those residents are still with us, so we're still counting. The cost savings to the state for three residents who have been released to us from various regional treatment centers is $2,423,820 to date, and also still counting. We currently provide care to residents with Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, brain injuries, people in coma, young adults, and elders with behavior problems. Some of our residents were homeless, some have no family to care for them, and others are alienated from their family. Many of them have drug and alcohol problems. All are devastated by disease or injury, which has resulted in their inability to live independently in the community. If we were not here, where would most of these residents go? Hospitals, where the average daily bed cost is greater than $1,000 per day per resident. Regional treatment centers, where the average daily bed cost is $932 per day. Into and out of nursing homes and hospitals when their behaviors become too difficult to manage, back and forth. The yo-yo effect, we call that. The average age of our resident is 55, while the state average is 82 and rising. 68% of our residents are males, compared to the state average of 25%. Our average length of stay is 450 days when we count our shorter-term residents, and for us, shorter-term is usually 60 days, compared to 338 days for the state. And if we take out some of our shorter-term residents, our average goes up to 1,975 days. 88% of our residents are funded by Medicaid, compared to the state average of 63%, and 19% of our residents are minorities, compared to only 10% in the state nursing homes. We are a licensed nursing home by virtue of the fact that there really is no other licensure category that captures who we are. We are not asking for your support of this bill because we are losing money and we want a rate increase to help us stay afloat. We are asking for your support because we serve a very vulnerable population, and we serve that population for the entire state of Minnesota, not just Hennepin County or the metro area. Anywhere from 20 to 30% of our residents are from non-metro counties. We are asking for your support because we are unable to continue operations in our current building. We are not losing money on the operations side, but we are bleeding capital trying to patch and repair a building that is too large and falling down around our ears. As an example, in the past 6 years since I've held this position, we've spent well over $3 million trying to stay ahead of the tide. We have had to replace chilling units for our HVAC system, and we actually have to replace the entire HVAC system in the next couple of years at the tune of another $2 million. Our pipes are corroding. Our concrete block walls are deteriorating, and we've just spent $750,000 replacing concrete block walls. Our elevators are hydraulic elevators, and I believe there's a federal mandate whenever they finally can decide on when they need to be replaced. It's kind of a moving target. The hydraulic elevator system will have to be replaced, and that will cost us another probably close to between $300,000 and $500,000. We've had to replace the hot water heaters. The elevators, as I said, will have to be replaced. We have spent a lot of money on KTAG compliance, and all of this still leaves us with a building that was built for 400 residents, so it's too big for our uses. It was not designed for the kind of population that we see now. It was built 35, almost 40 years ago, and there was a very different resident population at that time. It doesn't even have handicapped accessible bathrooms in the bedrooms where our residents live. There is one handicapped accessible bathroom per resident floor in this building. So we're looking at a building that is not going to take us into the future, and it's not going to take us very far into the future. The University Specialty Care Center is committed to providing specialty care. It is our mission, and we are passionate about our mission. We ask for you to demonstrate your passion to care for the least, the last, and the lost as well. Thank you for taking time to hear us today, and we ask that you vote yes to carry over House File 1812. And I'll entertain any questions if there are any.
And if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, we also have Jerry Zubar, the architect for the new facility, present as well.
Any questions? Well, seeing none, my only question is, what's the value of the property that your current facility is on?
Well, you know, I actually don't really know that, but it is located overlooking the Mississippi River, so...
It's right close to the Shriners Hospital?
It's about a mile away. Mm-hmm. We're right at the intersection of the Franklin Avenue Bridge and East River Road and 27th Avenue Southeast. So we get to see all the flotsam and jetsam going by this time of year.
So any further questions? Seeing none, House File 1812 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Representative Kalin and House File 1620. Representative Kalin. I'll move House File 1620.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. It's an honor to make my first appearance before your committee. Today, as you know, we're hearing from a problem that's kind of putting our fingers in the dam here to for some temporary relief. Hopefully, we'll get some long-term reform down the road when it comes to the rates for our nursing homes. And in Chisago County, we have like many collar counties, we are an in-between county. We are not part of the 7-county metro area, but for MnDOT, we are part of the 8-county metro area. We're not part of the Met Council, but we are part of, for housing purposes for the federal census, we are part of the metro area. And just as we heard from Representative Blyne, the situation in Rice County, in Chisago County, we really we feel the effect of being effectively being, for all pragmatic purposes, part of the metro area, but for rate purposes, not. And with me is Mary Cortes, who's the director of Parmley Senior Center in Chisago City. And before I hand it off to her, I just want to highlight with two statistics, kind of point out what the reality is in Chisago County. The cost of living in our county is 1% less than the cost of living in the metro area. The average wage is 37% lower than in the metro area. And those are the realities that we're facing, that the cost of running a nursing home in our community is essentially the same as the metro area, but our ability to attract long-term workers who are really going to stay and protect our seniors is we don't have that power right now, and that's what we're asking for you to do, Mr. Chair and Committee. So I'll hand it over to Ms. Cordes, who really knows her subject very well.
Ms. Cordes.
Good afternoon, and thank you to the chairman and the committee members for taking the time to hear testimony in response to House File 1620 before you. My name is Mary Quartz, the administrator of the Market S. Parmley Residence, 101-bed skilled facility located in Chisago County. Parmley has provided care to seniors for 102 years, and I have been their leader for 11. How can I make a compelling case enough to get your attention and keep your attention throughout this session amidst all the other issues and priorities on your plate? Senior services ought to be a priority for the state with the looming avalanche of elderly on the horizon and the financial crisis closing facilities across the state. The most recent study by Larson Allen of Minnesota Nursing Home shows a $20 per day gap between the cost of care and our Medicaid and private pay rates. And 57% within the study report negative operating margins. But I am not here this afternoon to make that case. The case I am here to make is the issue of geographic groupings and the additional negative impact that creates in the day-to-day operations of our organization. Please allow me to lay out what I believe to be our compelling case. In the 2004 legislation was passed, Minnesota Statutes 2002 Sections 256B.431. That legislation stated nursing facilities located in areas designated as metropolitan areas by the Federal Office of Management and Budget using Census Bureau data shall be considered metro. That was passed in 2004. The basis of that legislation was to address the changing census reflecting population shifting in the state and use an existing system to determine the qualifications to make the change from rural to metro. That was the intent of the legislation. The legislature was clear on that regard. Stearns, Benton, Sherburne, and Chisago counties fit this designation by the Federal Office of Management and Budget. We thought our inequity issue was finally dealt with. This chapter was closed. But DHS never implemented this legislation. Fast forward through the next legislative sessions, bills have been introduced. I've been before you before. No implementation until 2006 when Sherburne, Benton, and Stearns were moved into the metro classification with the rate adjustments, but not Chisago. In a nursing facility, 75% of our expenses are employees. The backbone of the organization and the largest employee group is the nursing assistants. They are the ones delivering the direct care to our residents. The rate disparity has a direct impact on their wages. As the leader of the Parmley residents, it is my responsibility to look our staff in the eye and explain why our wages are what they are. I say it's the system. We are in a particular grouping, and that results in the pay that we can pay for the work that you do. But we can work at changing that, and we need your help to talk with legislators. They control our reimbursement system. But we did change in 2004. We got the necessary legislation. I don't know what political winds blew, but Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne moved. Why not Chisago? When I look my staff in the eyes, tell me what I'm supposed to say to them. Please help make this right.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Cordes? see any, so we'll lay House File 1620 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Member.
And Ms. Cordes, we've heard this story before.
I know, but it's my job to come back. It isn't fixed.
And I did support the St. Cloud change, and we'll see what we can do on this one.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your consideration, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Faust? Yeah. House File 1804, Representative Faust. And Mr. Faust, aren't you the district just north of Representative Kalin's district?
That's right.
We could come and make the same arguments that they are, I suppose. But.
I will move House File 1804.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. I have with me today Mr. Jack LaRue, who is the director of the Villa Healthcare Center in Mora, and I will turn it over to him right away and save my comments for the end if we have time.
Go ahead. Please give us your name for the tape.
First of all, I would like to thank the committee and in particular Chairman Huntley for taking the time to listen to the issues of the nursing homes. Our industry is in desperate need of your help, and unfortunately you hold the keys to the car, and so I appreciate the efforts. I appreciate the demanding schedules you have and the compressed time frames that you have to deal with these issues, and so I just want to say thank you for the time. My name is Jack LaRue. For the past 18 years, I've had the privilege to serve as the administrator of the Villa Healthcare Center, the finest skilled nursing facility in Canawha County. The Villa was established in 1969, has 80 licensed beds to serve the frail citizens of Canawha County. We're located in Mora, Minnesota, a rural community of approximately 3,500 people. We have about 140 employees with a payroll of over $2.5 million. We are one of the major employers in our small rural community. As you probably heard numerous testimony today and throughout the session, long-term care is in serious trouble. We've experienced 5 years of rate setting that was well below our cost. This has hit every nursing home in the state of Minnesota. Please let me start by commending the committee for taking on the task of addressing these issues this year. I applaud your efforts to listen to issues like the cost of living, rebasing, bridging the gap between reimbursement between rural facilities and metro facilities. The desperation of this industry is evident by the sheer number of facility-specific bills that have been introduced this year. And action this year on these issues is paramount to the survival of the industry. I strongly encourage you to find funding to support an equitable rate reimbursement for services to our most vulnerable population. However, I'm not here today to discuss issues with reimbursement on our services. Please let me explain. Nursing home reimbursement is broken down into three components. The first component is for operations, and that covers salaries, supplies, food, utilities, things that operate the business. Then there's a second component called the pass-throughs. The pass-throughs are a dollar for dollar exchange, and they include the bed tax, the pre-screening fees, and real estate taxes. The pass-through has no effect on the financial operation of the facility. Like I said, it's a dollar in, dollar out. And finally, there's a third component called the property reimbursement. This is to pay for the bricks and mortar of the organization. Adequate funding should allow an organization to meet its mortgage obligation and to make necessary capital improvements over the years to ensure that our buildings stay safe and comfortable for our clients. This is not happening. Our current reimbursement may cover interest payments, but does not cover our depreciation costs, which funds future capital improvement projects. This is sorely evident by the average age of our nursing facilities, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 38 years. Please understand that the Villa has been a good steward of our resources that have been entrusted to us. Let me give you a brief history. The Villa was built in 1969. It was a well-built building, and like nursing homes of that age, it was built on the medical model. The rooms looked very similar to a hospital room. We had 11 three-bed wards and 22 two-bed wards. It served the needs of the resident at the time, but there was very little privacy. The facility was remodeled in 1979, 1985, and 1994 when we replaced the roof. In 1999, I applied for and was approved for a moratorium project. The moratorium project eliminated three-bed wards. Vast improvement in how we operated our business. We also added 7 private rooms, an additional dining room, and some common areas. The private rooms also had handicap accessible bathrooms, which we did not have prior to the project, and adequate space to accommodate equipment needed to care for heavier acuity residents. In 2001, we applied for another moratorium project. We were awarded the project, but due to the uncertainty of the reimbursement system at that time, we elected to delay the project. We weren't the only moratorium project in 2001 that elected to delay it. In fact, there was special legislation passed, I believe, the following year that extended the time for us to build our projects simply because of those delays. The uncertainty of the reimbursement system made getting financing difficult. But this was a project that was much needed, and we persisted and were able to get financing lined up in 2004, and we were able to complete the building project in 2005. But because of the delays mentioned above, the project costs have ballooned beyond the limits set by the moratorium process. Even with downsizing our project, our costs came in higher than the limit, requiring additional debt to finish the project. But this much-needed project accomplished many necessary things. Our building now is totally sprinkled. Before that, we had just certain areas that had a sprinkler system, mainly the south wing that was built in 99. But with this project, we were able to completely sprinkle the building, replace a 38-year-old nursing call system, add on 28 private rooms and 20 handicap accessible bathrooms. The project was much needed. We were also able to take care of some of the life safety code issues that are coming up in a lot of the discussions at the Capitol right now, things like emergency backup systems, your emergency powers, lighting of the exits, things of that nature. We were able to take care of with this building project. Our problem is not that we were poor stewards of our resources. In fact, the contrary is true. The problem was caused by necessary delays in the project, unanticipated expenses, an outdated property reimbursement system, and the limitations of the current moratorium exception process. The legislation that we are proposing is designed to relieve the financial stress caused by those issues. I have, for the committee, a one-page fact sheet that just kind of lists some basic information about the facility. First, the Villa Healthcare Center is under serious financial stress. The facility cannot. In fiscal 2005, we lost. Our operation loss was $59,600. This ballooned in 2006 to $423,000. The facility cannot continue to sustain these kinds of losses and survive. The villa will have an ongoing shortfall due to the current property reimbursement. Support of House File 1804 would help eliminate that ongoing shortfall. Without this legislation, we will not be able to meet the basic covenants of our mortgage, putting us at serious financial risk if they call the loan. This will have serious impact on our local economy, our 140 employees, but most importantly, our the most vulnerable citizens of Pineda County. Now, I understand that there are a large number of bills that attempt to fix reimbursement issues in nursing homes, but none of these bills address this specific issue. Most of the bills have been introduced address shortfalls in operational reimbursement. However, Representative Houston does have a moratorium bill to address some of the inequities of the moratorium process, but it's my understanding that that bill is prospective and does not address the issue that I have. So I would really highly recommend that you support House File 1804 to help address this issue for this facility. Any questions?
Any questions? We do have an amendment, and I'm not sure I moved the right bill, so why don't I start over?
Okay.
I'll move House File 1804, and then I will move 1804 DE1, which is a delete all, and does have some, I think we'll change the fiscal note, so we'll have to get that, and...
Mr. Chair and members, the DE1 amendment is actually just a technical amendment. It's moving the statute into the reimbursement section of the law. It doesn't change the actual language of the bill.
So the amendment's been moved. Anybody want to discuss the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the amendment's adopted. Any further discussion of the bill as amended? Representative Faust.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to underscore a few of the comments that Mr. LaRue made. And first of all, I'm sure you've had a steady stream of people coming in here from the nursing home profession saying that, you know, the rates are inadequate. And I'm sure that that is correct. And a big part of the loss that Villa Nursing Home suffered last year was certainly because of that. But they also suffer from the non-metro pay, but they still have the metro expenses that you've heard a few people talk about today. But on top of that, this facility has another problem, which is the inadequate property reimbursement. And so we've really got three strikes here, and we hope that it isn't three strikes and you're out, but three strikes and we fix it, because this is a tremendous facility. They do a great job there. It is by far the best nursing home in the county, because it's the only one in the county. And so they've usually had a waiting list for people to get in there, and so they've done a tremendous job, both as far as care and fiscally in the past years, and so it's extremely important to the local economy, and so I think that this does deserve special attention above everyone else. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Faust, and with that I'll move that House File 1804 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
As amended. Representative Keeson. House File 1836.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1836 be considered an omnibus financial, whatever the words are. So, and I'd also like
that'll work.
Thank you. And I'd also like to move the DE1 amendments, which is being passed out, I believe. And Ms. Cullen, I think the most efficient way to do this is have Ms. Cullen explain what we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Patty Cullen, with Care Providers of Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. The DE1 language that's being distributed right now is the language that was passed in the Senate yesterday. This is the Senate version of the one-time money language for nursing facilities. And this differs from the original bill in one significant way. The original bill had a process set up whereby facilities would essentially all get an equal amount of an increase to pay for life safety code sprinklers. And it's one of our mechanisms to try to figure out how we can fund some of the needs of nursing facilities using the one-time dollars. And this was the only category of our expenses that we thought we could do this. After some discussion in the Senate and after we kind of looked at the fiscal costs to do things such as the sprinklers, we worked on some language with the department, and so the DE1 amendment reflects those changes. The key change here is that the majority of the funds that are allocated will be used to fund sprinklers. Every time we get a news clipping service, and every time I see an article about another fire in a nursing home, I just hope we could act quickly to get the one-time money passed and to get the facilities that aren't fully sprinkled up to speed, because that's kind of our worst nightmare. There are, according to our data, about 64.7% of Minnesota facilities are fully sprinkled, but 28.6% are only partially sprinkled. 6.8% have no sprinklers at all. So it means about 114 facilities do not have the adequate sprinklers. There's a few other facilities in addition to these that might not have the exact amount of sprinkling they need for the new life safety code, such as sprinkling the walk-in freezers and the overhangs in their buildings. So this appropriation is set in backing into that number to be able to fund, as the language says, sprinklers. They have to do a quick turnaround. So we are ready to go to give our members information on what they need to send to the department by June 30th, and the department then would do a one-year rate adjustment. We do it this way, even though it's one-time money, to get the federal match. So in order to put in the rates for a year, you'll get the federal matching funds to do it. So we converted this into a one-time money bill. It has much of the same language as one of the sections in House File 401, which this committee has also heard.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think that last point, we've already heard this issue and passed on it. These are life safety code changes that they're required by federal law, and so the nursing homes are going to have to do it. And I think this is actually a creative way to solve one of these problems with one-time money and at least get a little relief to the to our nursing homes in that way.
Yeah. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a question of information because I'm new on the committee, but do the residential group homes also need sprinkler systems? Do any of them, depending on need, qualify for any of this kind of reimbursement?
I don't know. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the new requirement, the federal mandate that was published in regulation, applies to nursing facilities. And that's, we're looking at the new federal regulation that was published that is going to require all nursing facilities to be sprinkled. So it does not apply, to my knowledge, to all these other settings. And I think when you look at the group home situations, all of their life safety code compliance issues are much different than ours because it's residential, not institutional codes that are followed.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Cullen, in funding the capital improvement itself, do you typically get tax-exempt bond financing to do the improvements? I understand the rate adjustment to pay for it, but I mean, is there ways that we can reduce the actual cost of doing the work in some ways through the selling of revenue bonds or other sorts of mechanisms?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we actually looked at a variety of programs when we had an air conditioning issue a few years ago. For facilities that are city-owned or county-owned, they may have additional ability to do it through that mechanism, but the privately owned facilities do have difficulty in using any of the increment financing programs.
Representative Loeffler.
I understand where they wouldn't qualify for the tax-exempt revenue bonds, but it seems like even just government-backed revenue bonds would
potentially be a lower interest. I don't know if you particularly usually do debt financing on these things, but it seems like there might be a way even for the for-profits to lower the cost of the capital borrowing if that's actually how they pay for this. I'd be willing to look into it if you're interested. But
okay. We have not voted yet on the DE1 amendment.
Oh.
Any further discussion of the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, we will, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted the DE1 amendment. Now Representative Gottwald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too think this is a good use of the one-time money. I wonder, is the $6 million, is that meant to cover the entire cost for all 114 facilities or just part of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, we actually estimated that it'll cost a total of $22.6 million to cover all the sprinkler costs based on our estimates. And so we're actually a little short. We figure some folks may already be in the process or find other mechanisms. So the $6 million is matched with the federal funds, and so we're looking at $12 to $15 million, actually.
Okay, any further questions? I don't see any, but you folks are interested. My target from House leadership does not include any one-time money, so between now and next week, we'll have to do some fancy accounting. Mr. Walls. okay, all those, this bill, 1836, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and as amended. And there it's laid over. And next we have Representative Dietrich, who's been waiting here patiently for 2 hours to give us a brief presentation of her bill. House File 636, and I'll move to House File 636.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I have been before the Policy Committee before, and so I will try to be brief. House File 636 seeks an exemption from the current requirements for dentists who serve patients on medical assistance or Minnesota care. As you know, presently, a dentist who accepts those two health care plans is required to accept up to 10% of their patients from those health care providers. This bill provides an exemption from this requirement for dentists who are willing to serve children with special needs. Many of you, I bring this bill forward on behalf of Dr. Michelle Meiser, who practices dentistry in my legislative district, and on behalf of the children in this state who have disabilities. Dr. Meiser was here when I presented in front of the policy committee, and she gave a very eloquent and compelling testimony, and I will just highlight some of the things that she talked about. First of all, Dr. Meiser is a very highly qualified professional. Beyond the School of Dentistry, she took 2 extra years of training to become a family pediatric dentist. And that means that she is very highly qualified to treat and to deal with patients or children with disabilities. And when I talk about disabilities, I'm talking about children with autism, Down syndrome, Tourette's, those type of very difficult to treat patients. She had noted that it takes, when she accepts one of those patients, it can take up to 2 times longer to treat those children with disabilities than it does the average patient. She also pointed out that she feels like it is her ethical or moral dilemma, obligation to accept children with disabilities because she is highly trained to do so. Her dilemma comes, though, is where she does not want to be required to take the full 10% of children with disabilities. I believe that it is very difficult to find highly qualified professional dentists for children with those types of disabilities. and that when we have a dentist who is willing to take those children on and are highly qualified to deal with those those children, that we need to adapt the law and provide that option for those dentists.
Members, the reason this bill is here is the we don't know if there's a fiscal note, and while they're working on it, we'll probably know by Monday. And if there is, then it will be in the omnibus bill. If there isn't, then Representative Dietrich, you'll have your choice of whether you want it sent out as a separate bill or included in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
But we'll let you know as soon as we get a fiscal note. And Mr. Spizzetto, I had a question. It used to be that dentists also had to, in order to treat state employees, that they also had to meet the, I think it was 20%. Didn't we get rid of that at one time?
Mr. Chairman, we actually reduced that to 10%.
Okay, so.
And this is the Rule 101 provision that Representative Dietrich is talking about. In this particular case, we would be lowering that threshold to 5% for dentists who specialize in special need pediatrics.
Dominic, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Dominic Spizzetto. I'm representing the Minnesota Dental Association.
Just for members that are fairly new to this, there was a time that the result of having that 20% requirement for that they'd have to see MA patients or Minnesota Care patients, that up to 20% of their business, if they wanted to also treat state employees, meant that, at least in my part of the state, some dentists were refusing to see state employees. So state employees were having a problem, and it's one of those things that we pass, at least in my case, I supported that 101, but when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I can't help but comment to that comment that if we did that again, maybe we'd have better dental access for people around the state, and especially if we said that if they see legislators, they have to take...
Representative Abler.
I hope we can take care of this problem anyway. So yeah. This is a worth it.
Any other questions? If not, then House File 636 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, or depending on the fiscal note, sent out as a free bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee.
So with that, let me just announce what our timeline is. I don't want to have any too much secrets, but we hope to have the omnibus bill ready and have a hearing on it a week from today. Okay, and so it would be distributed to the public. I personally have no problem with if we ever get it finally done, and, you know, on Monday or Tuesday, showing it to Representative Abler or anybody else that wants to see it. So we'll have a hearing on the bill on Wednesday, or the presentation of the bill. That should be probably fairly short, certainly answer questions. And then on Thursday next week, we will have a public testimony on the bill. And on Friday, it would be my intent to hear the bill and deal with amendments and pass the bill to the Finance Division. So that would be 1 week from this coming Friday. If we get the million amendments and it takes too long, then we'll have to continue it over until Monday. But our deadline is it has to be out of this committee on Monday, April 2nd. Representative Thiessen, you had a comment?
No, I was.
Okay.
You just want one time.
Okay. Okay, with that, the meeting is adjourned.